You're listening to TV Madness with your host, Makeisha Madden-Toby. The highly anticipated new season of Mad Men kicks off in April, and AMC allowed reporters and critics to screen the two-hour season six opener and talk to the cast and producer Matthew Weiner. Best of all, we got to chat up Jon Hamm, who, let me just say this, even on his worst day, which I guess it sort of seemed like it was because he was losing his voice and he was wearing a scarf and he didn't seem like he was 100%, he was still amazingly charming, very funny, and everybody was like hanging on his every word. So that's Jon Hamm for you. While he couldn't say much about season six, he did discuss some surprises from season five and defended the show's right to be secretive, which, you know, it's debatable. They get a little paranoid, in my opinion. But you know what I mean? It's just one of those things that I guess I do understand when they say they want viewers to be pleasantly surprised or have that element of surprise. And so in that regard, you can understand them being secretive, but they still are very paranoid. Because here's the thing. We watched the first episode, the two-hour opener, and we couldn't even talk to them about it, really. So that was very frustrating, but it's part of the job, and that's part of the Mad Men experience, and you just have to go with the ride. Mad Men Season 6 kicks off Sunday, April 7th at 9 p.m. Check it out.
I get more information than most, I guess is the better way to say it. At least more than most of the actors, I think. Obviously, the writers are in the room, so they know, kind of, they see the board and they see how it all progresses, and they have to write it. So, but I get a lot of information, and I'm used as a sounding board on a lot of the stuff as well, I think, effectively. So there wasn't a lot of it that was a surprise.
Well, what were the big twists and turns of the season that really you're like, wow?
Ling's situation was a significant surprise, I think, to a lot of people. And I think Don's fidelity, honestly, was surprising to a lot of people. Again, not necessarily me, but it was, I think, an interesting way to progress the series and the character forward. And then, of course, set up the last two seasons and see what happened because of those developments.
What was your reaction to the script this season for the first episode? You literally don't say a word until, like, the eighth minute.
Number one, first of all, I didn't have a lot of lines. I didn't have a lot of numbers. You know, it was interesting for me. I think it's a, when we left off season five with the question, are you alone? It's different. It's a different question than are you single? It's a different question than are you lonely? And it's a different question than are you with anyone? It's are you alone? And what does that mean? And the reason we don't get an answer to that is because there's a lot of different meanings to that. And we open, you know, with a man sitting in paradise reading about hell. And I think that's an interesting juxtaposition. I think, you know, you see the key art, you see it as this progresses, you'll see a lot of dualities and two sides of this person. We also ended last season with Don walking out of the light into the shadow. We saw Don moving right in the spotlight and retreating into the shadow. I think that's so I think that again, where we are in the 60s, where we are in the culture at large, not just in United States culture, but world culture, in such a turbulent time, I think that all serves to add depth to this story, to this man's journey, and how is he going to navigate these increasingly choppy waters.
Now, we can't talk much about the season, but the advertising for this season is very interesting. The one poster that's been out there, are there any clues in there that we're supposed to be picking up?
Well, I think the central motif of it, obviously, is these two versions of this one man crossing. Which one are we supposed to be? They're both central. But which one are we supposed to be following? Honestly, one of them is with somebody, one of them is not. I think that's not, it shouldn't be lost from people. One of them has a briefcase in his hand, one of them doesn't. You know, it's a very, you know, it's a very rich image.
It's also the one-way sign and the police in the
background. There's a stop sign, and there's a lot of things. those aren't mistakes. if you guys have talked to Matthew, you realize that he doesn't He doesn't say, oh, well, let's put 12 tape recorders out here. 12 is a fun number. It's like, well, let's put 7. You know, he thinks about these things. And he's very involved in that. He's very involved in the choosing of this particular image and finding the artist we wanted. He wanted a specific style of art. I think somebody said, you know, that guy's still alive. Want to just have him do it? He was, yeah.
He's been doing it for 50 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. and honestly, that's an amazing opportunity to have that person come and contribute his you know, vision to the show. And when I saw it, I was like, because it's so different also from our normal stylistic kind of cues, which are very graphic and very sparse, and this is chaotic and different, and in many ways kind of suggests the world we're moving into. Bright colors and crazy, you know, tones, a lot going on.
There was a big disparity between where Peggy was headed and where Dawn was headed in the last season as far as her becoming more, I don't want to say more hip, but more sort of in the know, and it looked like people like Dawn and Pete were challenged by this sort of new political, hipper, maybe going into a beatnik sort of mentality. Without saying anything, does that sort of continue that disparity of not even personality, but of attitude?
I think part of what we're continually exploring is you know, time doesn't stand still for any of us, unfortunately. And the longer you survive in any industry, the more you run the risk of facing irrelevance. And as you grow older and the next generation comes up, and you find yourself out of step with music or popular culture or movies or TV or cinema or whatever, because you're old and have shit to do. Teenagers are built to consume popular culture. That's all they have time for, because that's all they care about. And this was the time at which that market segment just became the only market segment that was being appealed to. We're still in that world. The majority of feature films these days are pitched to 14-year-olds. I mean, they just are. Whether it's Twilight or Transformers or whatever, these huge, huge franchises, millions and millions and millions of dollars, because they're the ones that see it. And they buy the toys, and they buy the books, and they buy the magazines, and they buy the posters, and they buy the ancillary stuff. And that's not new. So Don, when he has people like Ginsberg and Peggy and Stan, the sort of younger generation, surrounded him, realizes that that's an asset. I think that's a big part of why losing Peggy was a particularly difficult goodbye. But obviously Peggy needed that place. Hello. There's no more seats.
God, I'll just kind of look.
There is a sofa. Oh.
No worries.
I think that is a difficult challenge to find that relevance again, find that place, or to accept the older patriarchal executive place in that world.
But that must be such a challenge for him mentally, because he was the upstart at one point. He was.
I think that's everybody's.
Whether you're
Tom Brady or whether you were, there's always somebody younger, hungrier, that's got a dream job. May not have the skill set that you have or the experience that you have, but there's always somebody else that's.
Or Alex Smith.
Do you think that part of his attraction to Megan was because she was part of this younger generation and he could learn from that?
Yeah. I mean, I think honestly, when you know, part of season 5's kind of hiccup was that Don and Megan were this dynamic duo at The Office, and then he realized that she didn't want it. But you're so good at it. Why wouldn't you? It's the greatest job ever. Not for me, for you. And that's a hiccup for him. She says, I want to go do that. Why on earth? I mean, you know, would you want to give all this up? because it's not her dream. It's Don's dream. And I think navigating that was a tricky thing. He says to her at one point, you want to be somebody's discovery, you want to be somebody's favorite. And I think that's a big realization, and I think a big thing for Don to do of letting that go.
If you could give Don advice, what advice would you give him?
Or, you know, I think I'll answer that question by answering the question in the living sense. I think, you know, it's more like, what do I wish for Don? I think that there's a world or a resolution to his issues where I wish for him to find peace and or balance and or happiness. If Don's life has been run out of balance for quite some time. And not to get to life pie, which was an excellent film. We haven't seen it this year. We find out more in season 6 about why Don is how he is, and why Don does what he does. And his house is built on a weak foundation. He's a fundamentally kind of damaged, broken. Yeah. And I guess, you know, I would wish for him to advise him to sort of fix that foundation and then kind of work on the house. Like, don't work on the house first. Work on the foundation first. I hope that was cryptic.
Speaking of cryptic, last season I remember our round table because you were talking about the poster that for that season, and you were like, you'll find out soon enough what it means, and of course it was the Joan episode. And so now I'm excited about, do you intentionally, are you like messing with us, or like, are you like, or is that just part of the job, or is it fun? It's fun sort of not being able to say anything but knowing,
you know. I think I've said this before, but I find it interesting that we become sort of standard bearer for this idea of being secretive, and I don't, it's not like I'm a TV fan, I watch a lot of TV shows, and I don't see anybody talk about their season at the beginning of the season.
They can't.
Well, no one does. Like, it's not like they came out of Homeland and said, oh yeah, by the way, here's how it's going to end. And yet, we're the kind of people who are known as the, like, cryptic secret keepers. So, you know, I think obviously part of the experience in television, especially in the media landscape that we live in now, is that it's so easy to have the experience be spoiled. You click on the wrong link, or you're reading a thing about maybe there's going to be an Arrested Development movie, and then you see the other links, and you go, man, they click, and then you're like, episode summary, and you go, no, I haven't seen that, what happened? I didn't want to know that. I just wanted to know about the Blues. and so it's so easy to disseminate that information instantly and globally. So I think that's we just try to be careful. We just try to be as careful as we can, because we don't want anybody that wants it to not have that experience of seeing it at their own pace. You can watch TV on your phone now, and you can watch it in your car. And you can, please don't, by the way. Driving the car and watching a television show, and it's personal for people. And I think people that like the show, and they want to watch it. They want to watch it. Some people come to the show late. I was a late adopter of The Wire. I started with season 5, and then I watched seasons 1 through 4 on my phone on a movie set over the course of about 2 weeks. And I mean, it didn't lessen the experience for me, because I hadn't read anything. And this was in a pre-Twitter era, I think, for me, which I still am in a pre-Twitter era. But it was just as real for me, because I had heard that it was great, but never heard any of the specifics.
That's good.
So I think, you know, we can hope that people come to the show however they come to it, but they get to experience it without it being sort of spoon-fed to them or told, oh, you have to watch this one, this one. This is why this means something. Like, who wants that? Then it's like homework. You know, then it's like you gotta do your popular culture studies homework or something and write a paper about it. Nobody, other than people that get paid to do it. The vast majority of the television audience doesn't sit into that.
You mentioned Lane's death last season. I think it really hit Don pretty hard, and he had a lot of guilt around it as well. Do we see that sort of lingering with him as we go on? Because I noticed the firm is still called Sterling Cooper Draper Price without getting anything
with it. We, you know, I think with a couple of the big events in Don's life that have ended badly or the way opposite to the way he wanted it, I'm thinking specifically of his brother's suicide, Lane's suicide, and Joan's decision last season. Don had the capacity to change those things and try. Mm-hmm. He gave his brother money. He said, take this money, get away from all of that, all of this. This will help. Go live your life. I can't be a part of it, but do that. And the brother went left and went the other way and ended his life. That sat very heavily on with Joan's situation. Joan, you don't have to do this. I will win this account. Please don't do this. I told everybody that we're not okay with this. Unbeknownst to him, it had already happened, but he had the best intentions. He finds out later that it didn't matter. That's that variable. And then with Lane, he finds that Lane is doing this. He initially covers for him with Cooper and says, no, it was me. I fucked something up. Don't worry about it. It's a thing. Confronts Lane, says, here's your way out. You can't be here, but there's a way out of this. Trust me. It's easy to start over at that many times. You will be fine. Lane doesn't take his advice. So I think it does resonate in his life that he, in a lot of situations, is very good at convincing people to do what he wants. And these three particular situations, life-altering situations, are good. And that's an interesting observation.
You directed another episode this season.
It's the best one.
talk a little bit about directing this season and the challenges of directing and acting and the schedule.
Yeah, directing him brought to me at the end of season 3. And I said, well, thank you. And then during the time between then and now, I saw John Slattery do it very capably. I saw Ben Affleck do it also very capably. And I saw Jennifer Westbrook do it also very capably. I'm talking about acting and directing at the same time. So I thought, okay, I have now seen a couple examples of this in action, and I think I might be a little bit more prepared for the responsibilities of this. And I did it last season. I did it again this season, and it was as interesting to me this season. I had a lot more to do in my episode this season as an actor, so it was sort of a degree of difficulty more challenging in that respect, because you are completely of two minds on set. It's a very, very difficult mindset to stay in. You're watching one thing as a director, and especially if you're in the scene, you're watching one thing as an actor. I remember getting scenes with Ben on the town where I would be like, wow, you are totally watching me as a director right now, not as an actor. It's a very interesting switch to be able to flip. And he's very good at it and justifiably lauded for his talent. But I found it, again, I think I said this last year, but it was a continuation of that. I found it really invigorating. And a really, really interesting perspective shift on a group of people in a set, in a situation that I thought I knew intimately. And you take your perspective from here and you can turn it 180 degrees and go, oh my God, I didn't even see that whole side of it. That's crazy. There's a whole thing that's happening behind me too. that's nuts. And it's just as an actor, your focus is constantly in front of you, and as a director, your focus is 360 degrees, and that was, once again, fascinating. And I hope I did a good job. I was obviously being facetious and saying that's the best one.
we had a very spirited discussion with Vincent earlier, discussing about you directing, and he said he's been searching for things that you're bad at and can't come up with anything. I think it would actually make a lot of male readers happy to know that you are bad at something. Is there anything that you're not good at?
There's tons of things I'm not good at. I guess I'm too friendly. No one's perfect, at least of all me, and he's very kind to say nice things about me. And if I may return the compliment, he is criminally overlooked on our show for what he brings to the show. He is a phenomenal actor and a wonderful guy, and is, in creating the character of Pete, has somehow made this person who on the page is loathsome. Punchable, I think, has been described in many an article, and yet has infused this character with this aching sadness and longing and vulnerability that is remarkable to watch. I actually had an incredible scene that I directed with he and Allison Brie, where I was like, I could shoot this all day. It was a long scene, and it was a lot of story in the scene. But it was like a little one-act play, and I was just like, I felt bad because they were both so good that we didn't have to do it 100 times. And they're both such wonderful actors that I could go to each one and say, okay, do the thing that you did where you're not going that way, and you're a little more this way, and then watch them play off each other. And I was like, let's do this all day. This is great. And that's Vincent. Vincent is his creation of Pete Campbell is ever evolving and, for my money, always interesting. So that's what I'm good at.
Is there another time period, era, decade that you would want to take a role in,
the '60s? I don't know. I mean, I think it's dependent upon the material. Honestly, a big Downton Abbey fan, fascinated by that world and how different that world is. I actually shot a TV show over in Buckinghamshire, which is kind of north of London. I guess Downton Abbey is east of London, west, I don't know where it is,
west.
Outside of London. And it was in one of these gigantor manors that was on 400,000 acres, and then sheep and cows and everything. And I was looking at this house like, oh my God. And the little caretaker comes up and goes, you know, this is only a third of the real house. Like, the other house had two more. He goes, yeah, this is the middle part. There were the two wings. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And they had lakes and trees. And just, it was this crazy thing. And I'm fascinated by that. I think that's part of what, you know, a small part, but a part of what a show is resonates with people, that it's close enough in our time that we recognize things like phones and cars and planes and briefcases and, you know, things that we have now, but it's also different enough so we're separate enough so we can kind of look at this planet and go, like, wow, is that not like that? So I would do.
Thank you.
Isn't that great? I love John Hamm. He's the guy you want to watch, and he's going to do great. Even after Mad Men ends, he's going to have a great career in movies. I'm sure of it. But this is the part of the show where we have to say goodbye, and thank you so much for listening to me, for listening to John Hamm and all the other reporters asking him all those questions. And hopefully, if you are a Mad Men fan, you're excited about its return when the show comes back for its sixth season on April 7th at 9 p.m. on AMC. Now, I have to thank Theo. You guys, you don't even realize, Theo is a mountain mover, okay? This man is amazing. I also have to thank NPR West, Leo for cleaning up the audio, production assistant and graphic artist Adam Janis, thanks Adam, and our sponsor, Record Surplus in Santa Monica, the last record store. Visit recordsurplusla.com. Thanks for listening. The star, the shine, the shine.